Just a few weeks ago, Ontario heard words that were greeted with cheers and caution coming from the halls of Queen's Park. I made a promise to you that I wouldn't touch the greenbelt. I broke that promise, and for that I'm very, very sorry. These are the words of sorry not sorry Doug Ford as he did a hasty but long delayed retreat on the greenbelt scandal. Some say this was corruption and that criminal charges might be forthcoming. Others noted that by opening the Greenbelt, Ontario wouldn't have helped to solve the housing challenges faced by Ontario in any case. What does Mike Marcolongo of the Wellington Water Watchers have to say? For the past few months, Mike has been at the forefront of the campaign to right this political, economic, and environmental wrong. Mike took a leave of absence from his job to devote his time to saving the Greenbelt. Today, Mike and Phil Ault discuss the Greenbelt, next steps, and the challenges Ontario might face as more developers attempt to initiate deals behind closed doors. Only in Vegas, you say? Pity it didn't stay there.
Welcome, everybody, to another breezy breakfast. I want to wish everybody a very happy Thanksgiving and thank Rise and Shine for allowing us to have this meeting where we are going to be dealing with Bill 23. And we have special guest Mike Marcolongo here with us. Before we begin, I would like to read the statement of acknowledgement from the City of Guelph with a couple of remarks afterward. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live and work in Guelph, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here, and we should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land, the people who live here today, and generations to come. If our actions today can move us towards reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. This place we call Guelph has served as traditional lands and a place of refuge for many people over time, but more specifically, the Adirondack and the Haudenosaunee. This land is held as a treaty land and territory with the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. Guelph lies directly adjacent to the Haldimand Tract and is part of a long-established traditional hunting ground for the Six Nations of the Grand River. Many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people who have come from across Turtle Island call Guelph home today. And with that, I would particularly like to remind everyone of the significant election in Manitoba recently, where Manitoba elected Wab Kanoo, a person with Indigenous heritage, as premier, the first premier essentially in Canadian history for well over 100 years who can claim ancestral rights. This is perhaps a positive step in moving toward more positive reconciliation, and as we can hope, will lead to the uncovering of the tragic burial of people in a landfill in Winnipeg as well. And with that, I'd like to welcome Mike Marcolongo, who many of you can see on screen. Mike is fresh back from the wilds of Northern Ontario. I think he's still got a little bit of canoe skin under his nails here.
Soreness.
And soreness. He didn't see any moose, but he did see a bear and showed me an incredible picture of a bear. And Mike, I want to welcome you here to talk about Bill 23 and any of the elephants that still might be as a threat.
It's a pleasure to be here and see a lot of familiar faces. And I'll be actually speaking about the Greenbelt as well as Bill 23. I want to take you through the last year of the Greenbelt controversy here in Ontario. In the past, I've showed up here to speak to the Claire Malpin Secondary Plan and to the Marcolongo Farm, and the fight was closer to home for me in the past. And starting in the last fall, I was able, because Claire Malpin came to an end, although it is being appealed at the Ontario Lands Tribunal, because that came to an end, I was able to devote some of my time to a larger cause. And Guelph is an amazing spring to bigger issues. And when I heard the Greenbelt was being carved up, I was upset, as most of you have been. And I took a year-long leave of absence from the public service. And myself and others, Guelph-based, Mike Balkwell, which many of you know, was a long time with the Wellington Water Watchers. We started a campaign called Keep the Greenbelt Promise, and I'm sure you've seen the signs around town. And in other towns as well, we ended up distributing over 9,000 lawn signs. But I'll get into the campaign in a minute here. I do want to emphasize here that the reversal on September 20th by Doug Ford was a surprise. We were just ramping up again, raring to go, and we were actually chasing Doug Ford through rural Ontario in the last 3 weeks of that campaign in terms of focusing on rural ridings. And that reversal was unexpected. I don't know if you heard him speak on the news about it. The press conference was expected at 4 o'clock. For some reason, he decided to speak to me at 3 o'clock, an hour earlier. I was just driving home when I heard it on the radio, and I could hear the bit of contrition in the voice, in his voice saying, you know, I'm sorry, you made a mistake. And we all know he's not sorry for carving up the green belt. He's sorry he got caught. And so, you know, we need to be diligent and over the next almost 3 years as, you know, this government is still in power. There's so many other egregious proposals from the past, from the last year and a half, from the last 5 years, but also moving forward, we're seeing additional stuff coming through the pipes. I'm just going to take you through the campaign quickly. So the Green of the Promise team and the campaign was one campaign. We also worked closely with Inland of Defense out of Toronto. And but the credit really needs to be given to grassroots organizers around the province. We, as a campaign, we really wanted to support what was already happening out there. In between November 15th and September 23rd of this year, there was over 128 rallies across Ontario. And our campaign's focus was, as I mentioned, on rural ridings. Doug Ford doesn't care about the Green Belt. Called it a scam. We all know that from his press conferences. But we knew that if we were putting pressure on his caucus, his rural MPPs, that our chance of success would be much higher. So we focused on 30 ridings, and in particular on cabinet ministers in 30 ridings in and around the Green Belt. In the end, I didn't mention, so we did, you know, a key, I guess, marker or a key demonstration of support was the lawn sign. And so we did distribute over 9,000 of those lawn signs. But we also knew that, you know, one of those lawn signs in Guelph was great, but it is Mike Schreiner's riding. But if we had a lawn sign in that rural MPP riding, that conservative riding, it was equivalent of one lawn sign there was equivalent of four or five or six in Guelph, right? So again, focusing on those rural ridings. We also focused on the rural audiences. So we led a rally in Toronto. It was the only rally we led in Toronto. It was at the Rural Ontario Municipalities Association Conference, so the ROMO Conference. That's where the rural politicians come to town. They all gather. They meet with poor government. And so that happened in January. And that rally was quite successful because you had the opposition politicians there at that event. The media was already in Toronto. So we had that rally outside the Sheraton Hotel. And it led to a lot of media attention and good things. Another one that we also led in Toronto, and I'll correct myself, was we had a Ford watchman. So when the House came back in early February, actually mid-February, after the Christmas break, which was 6 weeks, you can imagine. So the House, the Queen's Park, the House came back in mid-February. We had what we call the Ford watch. So we encourage people to go to Queen's Park and just fill the gallery, let them know that we had, the Green Belt wasn't forgotten after the Christmas break. We either led events, as I mentioned, the Roma or the Ford Watch event, or we supported events. So the Ford Fest counter protest, which happened in Kitchener about a month ago, we supported the Ontario Federation of Labour who led that event. And others, such as the Inchacha Pong match, we led a demonstration there. We also had a booth there. So there was, in terms of the campaign, there was an evolution. So right after the announcement, folks were quite livid about what was going on. There was a flurry of rallies. There was even another rally here in Guelph. On short notice, we had, I think, close to 400 or 500 people. And I think, Bill, you spoke at that rally. So at that time, it was easy to organize rallies. They were organic. They were being supported. They were just happening. During the spring, there was a slowdown, and as many of you know, I also had a serious accident, so I was also out of commission. And the campaign shifted more toward, there's some rallies we're still supporting, but also we were focusing more on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and so on. Also, kind of as you go into a campaign and you're reacting, you don't necessarily have the structures in place to support a longer campaign. So we spent a lot of time looking at how do we build infrastructure to support a longer campaign. We had, you know, we were distributing signs, but it wasn't very effective in terms of the distribution model. So we changed that up. We acquired software to really help us with that aspect. And we revamped our website. We looked at longer term goals, et cetera, et cetera. What changed for us was the Auditor General and the Integrity Commission reports in August. I think it changed for everybody because we kind of knew it smelled bad. But the Auditor General and the Integrity Commissioner confirmed that it's bad. It's really bad. So we saw that shift, and that shift was also it also meant it became less of a partisan issue and more of a, you know, this is corruption. This is not the way we govern in Ontario. And you could see that shift in numerous ways. I'll give you a couple examples. On social media, on Twitter, for instance, if I was rebutting a minister's post, I was getting more likes than the minister himself. So then you're like, okay, well, the minister has, 20,000 views. I only have 5,000 views, and yet I'm getting more likes. Okay, that speaks volumes, right? We also increased the use of Facebook ads, and we found that an effective way to get to our audience. So when we were running events starting in August, we started paying for ads. That was a shift in focus. And we also, there was a lot of debate in August. Do we keep doing rallies? Because, we had almost 100, about 110 rallies between October and August. And yet we didn't see much traction. We didn't see much of a shift in attitude. There were still rallies that were being organized. So we decided, well, let's support those, especially if they're in rural area and areas of rural Ontario where there wasn't rallies previously. So Markdale is a good example. The Markdale Hospital opening, some local folks decided, they found out what was coming. And so we had a rally there. We did some Facebook ads. We had over 200 people at a rally in Markdale. That was a shift for us, and it was a great shift. And what was great about the Markdale rally was we had people from surrounding areas. So we had people from Owen Sound, Collingwood, Meaford, Markdale, and so on. That day, we were able to get 4 new sign captains for that region, and lots of media because it was also the hospital opening. What was interesting is inside the hospital, the physician that had tipped off the organizers basically took off her clinician jacket, and she had hands off the green belt. Premier Ford wasn't taking any questions from the media. I do want to just quickly talk about Guelph as a battleground. So we had the December 5th rally. Guelph, it's a tricky situation. We're such a hub of activism and environmentalism and caring community. And yet, we have an NPP that is viscerally opposed to what was going on. So it was hard to establish Guelph as a center of protest. And yet, I think what we found was, with Mike being such a strong voice at Queen's Park in terms of the opposition, especially in the early days when Mary Style didn't yet have her full her legs, so to speak, in terms of this issue, of the issue. Mike was phenomenal in terms of keeping a singular focus on the corruption, on calling Ford out. And what happened over time is because there's so much of a, such a strong grassroots presence here in the city, is for For instance, when we had Forge Fest, the host tables at that rally where the petitions were, where the signs were being distributed and assembled, it was all Guelph folks that were doing that. I think Susan was there, right? Yep, there you go. Thank you, Susan. You know, Guelph played a big role in this battle, both in terms of, you know, a strong member of the opposition, leader of the opposition, but also in terms of the ecosystem that we have in place. I'm just going to finish up in terms of, you know, what were the key ingredients for the success? The first, as I mentioned, was the grassroots support. You know, we worked with everyone from the field naturalists in Prince Edward County to the small group of activists in Paris, Ontario, to the Agricultural Protection Committee in Markdale. So it was disparate groups across Southern Ontario. So the grassroots is important, supporting the grassroots. As I mentioned, the Auditor General and the Integrity Commission reports, those were instrumental. The Fifth Estate. So let's not underestimate the tenacity of both traditional media. So, you know, Colin DeMello at Global has been great, but also the Narwhal. The Narwhal is a nascent publication. Focus is only on investigative journalism. And those folks did an amazing job. Another key ingredient was the elected opposition. So the Mike Schreiner, as I mentioned, Merritt Stiles, and now we're seeing the emergence of a liberal opposition as well. So, you know, this is going to change in terms of the next 2.5-3 years. The last ingredient, which you couldn't quite tell from this room because it's mostly men sitting here, but it's women. The women were made up 70% of the activists in this fight. Yeah, easily. Whenever there was a rally, whenever there's a call, it gasped as well, yeah, the grandmothers act to save the planet. Whether it's in Hamilton, in Oakville, in Peterborough, 70% of the activists were women in this fight. That's also been, if you look at polling around support for the Greenbelt, it's always higher for women than for men. So we owe it to the women of Ontario. So thank you. I'm just going to finish up with, you know, there's more battles on the horizon. We still have the Greenbelt highways. So Highway 413, the Bradford bypass. We still have the forced urban family expansions. And, you know, that's getting more traction. I don't know if you read, I guess the civil servant released some of the details to the NDP about some of the briefing notes around the forced urban boundary expansions. That land is much larger than the Greenbelt in terms of size. And then we have Bill 23. So we'll be hearing about Bill 23 as, you know, we progress this fall into municipal budgeting across Ontario. But, you know, in terms of the largest wealth transfer from the taxpayer to developers with no strings attached, it's a travesty. We need to build, and so, you know, existing property owners need support, additional affordable housing, but this Bill 23 is not the way to do it. Bill 23 also has provisions that work against good conservation and conservation authorities. Right now, conservation authorities are undertaking a process to inventory all their lands across Ontario and dispose of those lands that could be used for housing. Now, I don't know about you, but conservation authorities, their expertise is in, you know, floodplains in terms of flooding, their expertise is in natural heritage protection, their expertise is in run a good conservation authority park. I don't think their expertise is in housing, but they've been asked to since January to next January, so January 2024, they're doing these inventories and they're expected to dispose of lands at a time when they're cash strapped, at a time when their budgets have been reduced by this provincial government. So there's more coming down the pipes, but the Greenbelt fight was a big fight. Very symbolic fight, and I thank you all for participating in that fight.
And thank you very much, Mike. I would remind people of two things. First of all, we are down at Rise and Shine with an incredible crowd, one of our better crowds since COVID, and I would encourage everyone to please join us down here if you feel comfortable. It's a great group, And I would point out that while there might only be two people who might identify as female here, online there are many that are at home. How can I forget Bev? Bev, who's been our chronic activist and supporter of this. But please come join us. We've got a great crowd today, actually. We're back up to our pre-COVID numbers today. Now, Tanya has a couple of remarks that she wants to make, and I think they are important.
I'd like to add two other reasons that I think in rural areas especially, which are general areas that historically have voted Tory, right? Full-time farmers know that fragmented farmland is detrimental to farming in general, right? And one of the things that Doug Ford proposed was to allow more than one severance to be allowed on a property, a farmer's property, right? And the reason given was to help farmers plan for, have succession plans. And I think a lot of farmers were a little bit insulted that they would need help from the government to plan for succession. So that those are two other reasons that I believe were key in the success against carving up the green belt. Thank you.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you. And I also note that Aaron in chat has pointed out that I forgot non-binary participants. And I think that's very important. About 2 weeks ago, there was a tremendous rally to support LGBTQ++ rights in Guelph. And I would be remiss if I did not point out that at that rally, the Green Belt was front and center as well. Now, Mike wants to make a couple of remarks.
Actually, I want to build on that in terms of that rally. So that rally came partly out of the crazy idea of a million march against trans, but it also came out of Ford's dog whistling at Ford Fest, where he said, educators and school board need to get out of the picture in terms of its identity. And, that's U.S. style politics, but it also shows the desperation and how Ford was trying to change the channel and conversation away from the Green Belt. I think Ford was hoping that in the summer kind of doldrums and before politicians went back to Queen's Park, the Green Belt issue would disappear. So in terms of the evolution, Ford Fest was interesting because there had been no significant rally at a Ford Fest over the last 5 years. There had been some activists who would, brave activists, I might add, who would go to Ford Fest and have a bit of a protest. But what Ford Fest demonstrated to us is that we could have a counter protest and have more numbers outside of Ford Fest than inside Ford Fest. And we made hay with that. We had some pictures, some screen grabs from the Tories' own, social media videos where it showed a pretty empty Ford Fest. And we heard that from the media as well. And we contrasted that with the protesters outside who had a lot of fun. If you were there, people had a lot of fun. But I want to go back to Tanya's point, which is well taken about rural severances. The additional proposal by the Ford government that lost a lot of rural support over the summertime was and the springtime was the changes to the provincial policy statement. So the provincial policy statement typically dictates how municipalities will create their official plans, how they will plan their communities. And one of the big proposals, one of the more controversial proposals, was to enable up to three severances per rural farm in Ontario. And the farming community went berserk. In terms of, farmers do want to sever for, an aging parent. Yes, that'd be like one severance. But three severances meant that all of a sudden farmers could become developers. And the challenge for farmers was not so much that, you know, they don't see an opportunity there, because a lot of them do see an opportunity there, but the challenge is with minimum distance separation. So from when you're you need to have a certain separation from a barn because of potential conflict with a resident. So the noise and the smell of a farming operation, the ministry has some very specific and strong guidelines around. So the Ministry of Agriculture has some very strong guidelines for that separation. And basically what it would have done is it would have hemmed in farmers into their property, and they could never expand, because all of a sudden you would have rural commuters moving into rural Ontario in a big, big way. And so the Kitchener-Waterloo group, so the Grand River Environment Network, they were quite active on that issue, working closely with the Ontario Federation of Agriculture. And the farming groups spoke out quite strongly on that proposal. And the PPS commenting period closed on August 4th. We're still waiting. Like, basically, the minister said, we're not going to be going forward with that proposal, but we're still waiting for the final Richard Paulson statement. But the rural severance issue did come up this summer. And, you know, also, I want to give credit to some of the academics at the University of Guelph who also looked at the implications. So rural planning academics who said, you know what, it's going to be essentially death by a thousand cuts for farmers in terms of introducing residences into rural areas, which will essentially freeze any expansions by farms and farmers in rural Ontario.
Thanks, Mike. And I do want to avoid this just being a history lesson, because I think we have, Susan, miles to go before we sleep. This is clearly something that that has been monumental in Ontario. But as I'm listening to you speaking, and I'm looking at opinion polls as well, when I consider the Manitoba election, and I consider what the Alberta government has tried to do with pensions, I think in many respects that what we are seeing is the politics of division that are occurring. Ford tried to do it here by refocusing on schools and the role of schools versus the role of parents. We saw it in Manitoba, where they tried to make a murder and a burial in a landfill site a divisive issue. We see it in Alberta with regards to the Canada Pension Plan. How much do you think that played into the issue of the Green Belt? Do you think that Ford and others were successful in these politics, or was this a failed effort?
Yeah, that's a good question, and especially with what we saw just in Manitoba over the last few days. Ford is essentially at the same, he's polling at the same level as the former premier of Manitoba. So, if this continues, it could bring quite a significant shift here in Ontario. I think politicians did well during the pandemic, regardless of your political stripe, right? Most politicians agreed with public health officials. They worked they rallied the troops, right? They rallied society. We worked together to get through the pandemic. And unfortunately, what's happened since and transpired since the pandemic and during the pandemic is the inequality has increased. We're seeing it in housing. We're seeing it on our streets. We see the homeless in our community increasing all the time. I was in North Bay last night. They have the same issues, and it's happening across every mid-sized community in Ontario. And I think we're all fed up, right? We are a wealthy society, and folks are saying now, okay, so we got through the pandemic. There's we're not in a recession. This government is basically is stowing away billions of dollars. They're not funding public services. We've got Bill 124. Public services and wages have been frozen for many years. This government keeps going to court to fight that. There's no transparency around the mandate letters. This is not the kind of government we need in Ontario, right? And so I think, Canadians, Ontarians, we're fed up. Healthcare as well, right? We need to build on this momentum over the next 2.5 years and build, what kind of society do we want to live in? As opposed to just saying, this isn't good governance. No, this is not okay. What is the model we want to live in? I think there's a wave starting. I hope to see this wave continue, and I'm hopeful.
And just to point out, public opinion poll by a pollster that I don't know that well, Palace, came out 2 days ago, shows public opinion in Ontario running 33 Conservative, 27 New Democrat, 27 Liberal, and just below 8 for the Greens, and a little bit less for others, which I think speaks volumes. Ford has been in free fall. I don't think that we should believe that that is going to occur forever. There is a floor at which the Conservative support will remain. But nonetheless, those numbers are important. And that leads to another question. And that question is Bonnie Crombie. Bonnie Crombie, who apparently will potentially be crowned Liberal leader, has been accused by some of her competitors of taking donations from the very same developers and having the same perspective on greenbelt and development as Doug Ford. What do you think of that?
I always look at the opportunities. I mean, if it looks like Bonnie will be elected, I think it opens the door for a stronger progressive politics in Ontario in terms of the NDP, in terms of Merritt Styles, in terms of Mike's politics. Bonnie has been called Ford Light. I wouldn't disagree with that. But I think it points to a bigger question, which is there's an ethical dilemma here. This is not just about provincial politics, it's also about municipal politics. We need to move away from funding by developers for our elections. It's a travesty. It's a total travesty. The Trillium did a great piece about 3 weeks ago on the group of developers that worked for the carve-outs in the Greenbelt. So the Silly Digas Berries, the Michael Rices of the world. And they did a deep dive, not just at provincially elected officials, but at the municipalities. So Kevin Ash, who's the mayor of Pickering, he got, out of those five developers, he got a total of $26,000, right? So, so when Kevin Ash voted on the municipal comprehensive review process, and he voted to, significantly expand their urban boundary expansion, was it informed by those $26,000? We need to rewrite how we finance elections in Ontario, municipally and provincially.
And thank you for bringing up that point about the developers in the eastern part of the province. I was going to actually raise that as a question. Those were substantial amounts. And it raises a point that New Democrat leader Merritt Stiles raised, and I'm somewhat loath to raise, but I will regardless. Not breezy breakfast hour, alleges corruption. And there have been so far 4 casualties for the Conservatives, a couple of cabinet ministers, a couple of significant civil servants. Without going out on a limb, if that's at all possible, are we looking at deep corruption on this issue?
So that's an interesting one. So after the Auditor General report came out, so before the Integrity Commission report came out, And I think Spencer's sounding partial, and I'm impartial. I don't subscribe to any political party. Merritt Stiles, I know from having a conversation with her on this, in mid-August, she did say the C word, corruption. And that was a watershed moment for Ontario politics, because no other political leader had said corruption at that point. And I know there was a lot of deliberation internally within the party about, can we call this corruption? And she said it, to give her credit. And after she said, Mike also started using the word corruption. I think what's happened is Bonnie's report, so the Auditor General's report, did point to corruption. And then we got the Integrity Commission report, and that led to more dubious workings. And finally, I think what happened was when the media, the state, started investigating around the Vegas Strip, and Shakir Rimtula, who's a developer who played in Eastern Toronto and North of Toronto, when it was, when those dates got mixed up and the MPP Rashid and himself had, some great massages in Vegas. And as we all know, what happens in Vegas sometimes doesn't stay in Vegas. I think that clearly pointed to corruption, right? It's just that overwhelming evidence, and there's more coming as well. I know that Noor Javed from the Toronto Star and the Narwhal, they're still working on other stories. There's more coming. I think we can safely say there's been corruption.
And actually, you mentioned the Narwhal, and I think that's very important. One of the challenges that we have had, and I think we've had throughout this whole event, is the absence of media, just because we are in a post-media age. I do want to remind people that the Narwhal and other publications and other podcasts are extremely good on this. And Mike, I was wondering if you could point us to good sources of news. And I won't pretend that Breezy Breakfast is neutral. Surprise, surprise. Where can you point us to where we can get good, critical journalism?
Good question. As you mentioned, the Narwhal. So young reporters, Emma McIntosh, among them, Fatima Sayed is another one. They're doing great work. The Trillium, which is a Queen's Park base, most of their articles are subscriber articles, but the really great ones, they make them a non-subscriber. So check out the Trillium, that's Queen's Park space. The National Observer also does some great articles. There's, I think you get a few free ones and then you have to sign up. And also the key collaboration between the Toronto Star and the Narwhal, that's brought up some really great articles.
And I would remind people locally that Scotty Hertz and Adam Donaldson do a great job every Thursday afternoon at 5 o'clock. They get into some really deep critical analysis, yep, not just of local politics, but national. And I would also point people to Canada Land too, as a place to get some good critical journalism that isn't necessarily just from the CBC. So even though certain politicians can point to the CBC as being the thorn in their side, I think that there are many thorns that are hoping to burst many, many bubbles.
Well, political.
Thank you. Let's not forget Adam Donaldson's blog as well. Mike, the question that remains for me, what have we gained or what have we recovered? And I want really specifically to point out the challenges that apparently still exist. Stiles has raised them, I think Mike Schreiner has as well, in Ottawa, Hamilton, and I heard in Guelph as well. Where are we going with this? It seems like I don't want to put a closure on this. I think what we've done so far is just opening the gates to a more critical inquiry.
Yeah, so you're pointing to the forced urban boundary expansions. So the largest forced urban boundary expansions are Halton region, I believe 8,000 acres, which is huge. I mean, that's roughly, let's say, 5-6 times Claremalpie. Hamilton, again, I believe they're looking at 3,500 to 4,500 100 acres of forced urban boundary expansions. Here's a, you know, Hamilton's a good example. You have a community that had a referendum, 80% of residents in the city of Hamilton said, we don't need to expand our urban boundaries, we want to grow up. And the Minister of Housing, Steve Clark, said, we don't care. We're going to force you to expand. And here's the map. So Hamilton, I spent a lot of time in Hamilton on this campaign. Hamilton also had the second largest greenbelt carve-out, the Book Road property, which includes a lot of significant species at risk and endangered species. What's interesting there as well is there's a real mix of developers in that area. You know, call them developers, mostly now we know they're speculators. I think the other ingredient that led to the downfall of the greenbelt grab was developers who were successful in getting those carve-outs and then flipping those properties, right? And you were like, I thought this was for housing. No, it's just for speculation, right? So the, you know, early in the, well, in August, one of the properties was returned right away in outside of Markham, when it turned out that it was a Chinese investor who was just flipping the property and was actually looking at developing industrial lands as opposed to housing. What's interesting, and we all love the agenda, right, with Steve Bacon. Jeff Bacon is Steve's brother. He's involved. He was involved in one of the carve-outs in Hamilton. If Steve has been a little mum, it's not just because of the strike. It's also because his brother's involved. But forced boundary expansion in Guelph, it's an interesting one, right? Because the I've been away for a few days in the wilderness. I did read an article last night, and I didn't realize, we know that one of the big interventions by the province, by the Minister of Housing for Guelph's official plan was essentially all of the downtown. You can go up to 23 stories, right? And so that hit the news quite early on. Yesterday, I read about the cold storage facility, which I understand the municipality is having issues with, the proponent not submitting the correct reports, right? So the environmental impact studies and so on that typically do as any large site plan development. And then I didn't realize that cold storage facility exemption was one of the ministerial interventions. It kind of makes sense now, right? You would have a proponent that says, well, I'm just going to go to the province, right? And so what it's doing, those forced, urban boundary expansion, it's much bigger than that. It's also about saying, municipalities, we don't care what you think. We're going to intervene at whatever cost. These proponents have a direct line to the minister's office. And then the minister's staff walk in and say, you will do this, right? That is not democratic. And so the arrogance of some of these proponents, and we're seeing that now with the cold storage, at least that's the way I'm reading it, we're seeing that arrogance with proponents here in Guelph. Is that how we build viable businesses that want to contribute to your community? No, it's not the way to do it.
Yeah, and a couple of questions from people who are here, both in Breezy and online. The first one, I'm just going to make mention. Their question was, if the province forces expansion, will they help with funding infrastructure? And that is a tremendously important question. What we understand now is that they believe that their assistance with funding infrastructure will be taxes that municipalities collect within the future. When they have done the books, they have said all communities will be made whole, but it's over time, as far as I know. Mike, do you have anything further to say that?
Yeah, so it's fascinating, right? So, and you'll see the tone and shift in terms of the campaign now, and you'll see this, especially in Hamilton, if you follow Stop Sprawl Hamilton. Their focus now is on urban boundary expansion. And they're speaking to the taxpayer. They're saying, why would we fund this growth that we don't want or need? Development charges don't cover the full cost of development. And study after study after study has shown that. And you'll still find developers that waltz into council chambers and will say, we paid growth. It just doesn't happen. And it doesn't matter if you're from the left or the right or the center, it's not a partisan issue. Development charges don't cover the full cost of development. So it's bold for the province to say you will expand, you know, by 8,000 acres or 4,500 acres here, because the taxpayers will have to fund that development. And the province has said, you know, since this government has said since Bill 23, which was introduced last fall, over like essentially a year ago, has said we will make you whole. Municipalities will make you whole, and they keep making that promise. We just haven't seen how they intend to make municipalities. The same charade happened with the Greenbelt carve-outs. So with the Greenbelt carve-outs, the carrot that was being dangled to municipalities was the promise was you will get community benefits. So you'll get long-term care homes, you'll get new clinics, you'll get all these great community benefits, recreation centers. Developers will pay for that. And so it's an interesting way to start the conversation, as opposed to this is your, typically what happens in planning is you've got this large area that's to be developed. You typically do a secondary plan. You look at population projections. You look at this is their capital program. This is the impact on the operating budget for the municipality. None of that was done. No, the conversation that started was, here are your community benefits, right? It's putting the cart before the horse. So to give the city Hamilton staff credit, they decided, well, this isn't typically how we do planning. So let's have a couple of public meetings. And so they had two public meetings in early September, discuss the community benefits. And the first was at the Ancaster Theater and Stop Sprawl Hamilton, which is an amazing organization, well organized. They had over the capacity for the Ancaster Theater is 450 people. They had 450 people there in no time, and there was 300 people that couldn't get into the building. And the activists decided to change the conversation. The conversation should not be about community benefits. It really should be about what is this going to cost us? What are the implications of the carve-outs? So I think you know, this government has not made municipalities whole. Bill 23 will worsen that. And until there's clarity on that in terms of either a funding program or a real willingness to make municipalities whole, then I would be skeptical.
I actually think that we misheard them. They said we will put you further in the hole. Yeah, we have a number of speakers here, and as I go to you, I'm just going to read from the chat from Aaron Caton, and then I'll probably go to Aaron after I get to the speakers here. Enacting policy before you have a plan of how you're going to support it or have any details in place is fundamentally flawed process, and indeed, I agree with that.
So John's question was, given, you know, the premier's ability to skirt, and given the premise premier's dishonesty on various bills, Friday afternoon announcements is something all Ontarians have gotten used to. How can we trust this government to return the parcels to the Greenbelt with the same or better protections? Because the word was, I think they used the word, we will codify protection for the Greenbelt. A couple of weeks ago, as the provincial politicians were returning to the legislature, Merritt Stiles proposed the Greenbelt Restoration Act, and that was voted down at first reading, which is very unusual. And our new housing minister, Paul Calandra, said, oh, we're coming up with a bill. It'll be available in a couple of weeks. So the question is, will that bill entrench protection of those Greenbelt carve-outs? We're going to be watching very closely. There's actually, it's more complicated than one thinks at first blush. So it's not only about returning those parcels, there's also the question of compensation. So some developers said, well, you know, you've we went through with your process, and now we've lost significant fortunes, right? We know that it's $8.3 billion in, I believe, 2016 dollars from the Auditor General's report. So that's a lot of speculation, right? So a lot of Ontarians are skeptical at first and said, you know, will these developers be handsomely rewarded by the taxpayer for for participating in a very flawed process? So Calander and others have reassured Ontarians in the media that no, there won't be any compensation. Interesting. And so that's one aspect. The other aspect is the Dufferin's Rouge Agriculture Preserve, which is the largest carve-out, which is 4,000 acres outside of Pickering, which is mostly owned by Sibley de Gasperis of TAC. Under Bill 39, that the protection for that area, which is agricultural easements, was removed. So we'll be looking to ensure that agricultural easements are also returned to those parcels. And so the devil's in the details, and your point's well taken. The fight's probably not over.
Thanks, Mike. Just a comment from Morgan. Councillors asking questions of staff that they can't answer because regulation have yet to be provided has been a common theme at meetings since Bill 23 came down. And that's quite true. I'll be quite blunt. It's from long before that. We can't answer questions about everything from the merging of wards in Toronto when the number of councillors was reduced to the current times. This is clearly a pathology of this government. And it leads to one question, because I am wondering, and I am quite serious about this, whether this is Ford's Spadina Expressway. And the important point about that is, if you recall, the Spadina Expressway was tremendously controversial and led to tremendous advances in heritage protection in Ontario as a consequence of activists in Toronto getting together. Bill Davis, in his wisdom, decided to cancel the Spadina Expressway. That led to a number of conservative re-elections, because Davis, who was regarded as a right-wing premier until that time, had moved to the center. And Mike, before I get to the other questions that we've got here, do you think that this can be used as his Spadina Expressway, or is this seriously spiraling damage?
Yeah, that's a really good one, because you know, in no time, Ford will be saying he saved the Greenbelt, right? Right? We know that's going to happen. So, you know, and this is the sad part of politics, is that, you know, these issues, unfortunately, don't have a very long shelf life, right? And so we need to, I think it's incumbent upon us to organize over the next, you know, 2.5-3 years to remind Ontarians, you know, the Greenbelt happened. We had to work so diligently. So many sacrifices were made to save the Greenbelt, and that there's these other egregious proposals at play right now. Politicians are great at spinning it to benefit themselves, and you know, Ford will try to use this as his Bill Davis moment, as you allude to. I think it's also important for us to remember that Ford is not the smartest politician, right? He's only as good as his advisors, right? There was speculation as late as last January, February, that Ford was going to step down. And that would have made our fight for the Greenbelt even harder, because the Greenbelt issue was so intimately attached to Ford. And so if you have another politician who then leads the party, how do you they ensure that politician wears a Greenbelt fight, right? Or the Greenbelt loss, which was a big conversation we had amongst ourselves as in our circles. If you're asking me for my opinion, I think Ford is staying on for much longer. And I think we saw that because Monty McNaughton resigned and he stepped down. Monty, as you know, was an upcoming future leader for the party. And he stepped down right after the Niagara Falls retreat, when Ford reversed the Greenbelt decision. Monty said he's going back to the private sector. And to me, and to a lot of others, it signaled that Ford is not moving on. He's not making room for future leaders, and that he intends to stay on. That to me is an opportunity. We need to pin what's going on to Ford, and we need to work over the next 2.5, 3 years to ensure that this government does not get reelected as a majority.
Have you any idea how much resistance there was in the caucus meeting in Niagara Falls? Have you any inkling behind closed doors how much of an earful Ford got? And the second question is, you mentioned the word corruption, and we know the RCMP have been told to look, is there criminality? I know you're not a lawyer, but is there criminality involved? I'm going to take a stab at a couple of those. First of all, when I was at the Association of Municipalities of Ontario meeting, the reaction of the rural delegates to that convention was so strong that caucus was taken significantly aback. There are people that are concerned for their positions. As you know, politicians get comfortable in their positions and don't want to leave them. So I think that there is anxiety within the caucus. I don't know whether you need to say anything more about that or not. I'll just pass it over to Mike quickly. And then the other one about criminality. What I've been reminding my lovely wife, Elizabeth, of is that we are not going to see this move quickly. This is an investigation that's going to take time. And if the RCMP is involved, they're going to be thorough to the point where they determine whether they have the foundation to lay any criminal charges.
I'm not going to speculate on the RCMP involvement. It's, you know, I have no experience with that in terms of what are they looking for in terms of what's considered corruption. The lobbying and there's such a gray zone there, and what is considered criminality. I'm not sure, so I won't speak to that. What was interesting, however, was that the OPP decided to hand over the investigation to the RCMP. I think that speaks volumes, and I think that's important as well. The Ford government has a close relationship to the OPP, and we know that. And you know, that gives me hope that, you know, it'll be taken more seriously. But on the other question on caucus, right. Yeah, no, what was interesting there was whether it was Ford Fest or whether it was the International Plowing Match, Ford knew he was losing support by both Ontarians and some of his caucus. So it was performance command for his MPPs to be at Ford Fest. He was surrounded by them. It was actually surprising. And they were all behind him on stage at Ford Fest, which was unusual. The previous Ford Fest, it was more of a party, more informal. At the International Plowing Match, he had about 50, 55 of his MPPs there. And they knew they were losing support because people were being polite. Rural Ontarians are polite. But there was no, you know, it was very, there was no overt applause for the caucus as they were making their way through the tent city. So typically, you know, they get on their, for Ford, it would be the Ford Blue Tractor, and they're pulled by hay, you know, pulling a hay wagon. It was very muted support there. And so that was an indication. We also know from, you know, having our ear on the ground, numerous riding associations, presidents or supporters have been leaving in droves. So Peter Bethenfalvy's chair of his election campaign has basically quit the party because of the Greenbelt scandal. So they're trying to shore up support, but they've lost a lot of support by rural Ontarians. For us, we had a booth. The Greenbelt Promise campaign did have a booth at the International Plowing Match. Most of the audience there is farmers, are farmers. Most of them are conservative. And while, you know, I would say the majority weren't taking lawn signs, the majority were signing the petition. So not being overt, but certainly not supporting what's going on. And what changed for them was the Auditor General's report, the Integrity Commission report, the corruption. They just can't support that.
Thanks, Mike. I'm going to go to Glenn and then to Susan and then to Mike.
Thank you, Mike. My question was partially answered through John's question, but what I wanted to start off with that at the time, something that really bugs me that you don't hear very much about anymore is the cancellation or and dismantling of the wind turbines back at the beginning of Ford's mandate. And I don't remember the exact figures in that, but I gather that that ended up costing us somewhere in the neighborhood of $280, $300 million or so. And what really bugged me about the whole situation was that these turbines were built, they were ready to be put into operation. The only thing that needed to happen was them to be connected to the grid. And Ford had made the promise that he'd get rid of them. And sure enough, shortly after he got into office, he dismantled them and was quite proud to say that it cost us, you know, $280 million, but he saved us billions, my exaggeration, but it saved a lot of money, you know, in future contracts. I was going to ask about lawsuits by developers and, you know, if there were lawsuits, would that end up costing us a whole bunch of money? Because you had mentioned that they're, you know, stockpiling all kinds of cash. And I was just wondering that if there are lawsuits, you know, is this going to end up costing us again with the reversal of the Greenbelt?
The lawsuit question is a very interesting one. And I think that's why we're seeing an RCMP investigation. Certainly Ford has been very clear that there is no compensation. I was astonished at that, to be honest. And Mike is wondering, any comments?
Yes. I mean, we'll see what transpires. I think we can expect lawsuits. You know, having worked in government and having been part of statements of claim, and some of them are vexatious, right? The reality is that the loss of $8.3 billion is a lot of money. Lawyers, you know, if it costs you a few hundred thousand dollars, that's nothing to these developers, right? So I think, you know, if you look at the cost benefit of hiring lawyers to go after the Crown, I would, you know, dollars to donuts, there will likely be lawsuits in play. I mean, you can legislate that there's no compensation, but you know, lawyers will convince the developer that there's an opportunity here if they can. I think we should look at what happened in 2005 when the Greenbelt was established. There was lawsuits there, right? Sylvia DeGasperi's of TAC did sue McGuinty and his housing minister, and it was a vexatious lawsuit. He lost, and I think the penalty was $795,000 for the developer, which is not huge, but it was one of the largest penalties at the time. And if I remember correctly, the judge and landed on that figure because it was the number of acres that was being protected in that area for the Oak Ridges Moraine. So it's 785,000 acres. So it was trying to send a message to the developer that the lawsuit was vexatious. But I want to go back to your point, Glenn, about the wind turbines and the dismantling of the turbines. And I think you're referring to the White Pines project, which is in Prince Edward County, just outside of Belleville. Now, that project construction was almost completed. You're correct. The turbines were dismantled. The developers were compensated. That's Todd Smith's writing, and he's a cabinet minister. What's interesting there is the Prince Edward County Field Naturalists were actually opposed to the project because the Blanding Turtle is in that area. So it pitted environmentalists against environmentalists. And the Prince Edward County Field Naturalists actually had a good relationship with the minister because of, you know, they were quite concerned about the turtle habitat. But when Bill 23 happened and when the Greenbelt carve-outs happened, and the field naturalists were raising concerns about the Greenbelt and about Bill 23, Todd Smith stopped meeting with them. So So you know, it's the politics, the convenience, right? Unfortunately.
Yes, and that was very clearly an attack on renewable energy and electrification. One of the things that my wife Liz is really upset about is this government pulled out every charger along the 401 and 400 for electric cars, and there was no other reason for it other than spite and dislike of electrification.
Now, I wanted to ask about the relationship of the Therm project at Ontario Place and the Science Centre. I read a very quick, and it never appeared again, Facebook post that the Therm sort of arching company, however it's called, had bought Doug Ford's label making. So he had an insider relationship with the Therm executive. And we never had the lease terms. And in the next week, they'll be cutting down 800 trees at our expense. That and the Science Center move and the Moriyama issue of demolition of that beautiful property. What will happen with that? Do you think Ford will get his way on those two projects as well?
Good questions, and I think that this points out why the Green Belt campaign has been so important. I believe personally that Bill 23 and other issues would never have sustained the concerns of the public without the Green Belt taking precedence. And I think you've raised some very important issues there, Mike. Any comments?
Yeah, there are parallels with the Green Belt and Ontario Place, as well as the Science Centre. I mean, one, it's policy making and decision making on the fly, and it's not well thought out. But the other, you know, key denominator is it's a land grab, right? It's privatizing a public space, or a public function. And in the case of Ontario Place, I mean, it's hard to believe Ontario Place is pretty much shuttered, except for the concert hall or theater. And I was just reading this morning, I think last year they saw 2.2 million visitors, right? It's an incredible amount. I mean, it's a stunning green space within the city of Toronto. The challenge for the folks that, you know, the activists that are trying to save Ontario Place is that they need to get more Ontarians to identify with Ontario Place. It's not Toronto Place, it's Ontario Place. And right now, you know, the struggle is Torontonians identify with Ontario Place, the rest of Ontario not so much, right? And this government is a rural government, and they need to get more Ontarians to identify with the legacy that is Ontario Place. You mentioned the architect Moriyama, who built or designed the Ontario Science Centre. He also designed parts of Ontario Place, right? I mean, that's it's quite a legacy there. The yeah, the you're also alluding to the Facebook post around the relationship between Doug Ford's Deco label and the Therm executives. I did see that on social media. One of the executives, or the investment branch of Therm, was involved with Deco Labels buying the Chicago branch of Doug Ford's company. I haven't seen any mainstream media pick up on that. So I've been puzzled myself on that question. I think what's interesting there, you know, in terms of the land grab, so privatizing a significant public asset, I think that's one aspect of Ontario Place. The other one is the procurement. So you mentioned the 95-year lease. It's not been public. There's been numerous calls to make that 95-year lease public. I think we should have that transparency at a minimum. And then around the procurement is Therm seems to have had a kind of a hand up in terms of the province is going to be funding the garage, I believe 450 or $500 million at Ontario Place, and none of the other proponents had that information or advantage, right? So the procurement is rather fishy.
Hey, we're going to go to a couple of quick questions. We got Mike right here, and I think Ron might have had a question. I'm not certain.
Okay, just a quick comment first. I was part of the anti-Spadina Expressway going downtown in the fall of 71. And one of the reasons why Bill Davis backtracked was that in the fall of 71, you had the municipal election, and David Crombie made that part of his rallying call, where everyone has a right to come downtown, but you can't bring 2 tons of junk with you. And that's part of the reason why it's like the rallies you're talking about in rural Ontario. Well, the Stop Spadina movement was taking place just outside the doors of the provincial parliament, and you could not ignore it. And it was the first time we'd actually had a reasonably progressive mayor running in a race in Toronto, as opposed to those who were very development oriented. One of the issues I'm thinking of, and you've touched on it, Mike, is how do we keep this going? I mean, this is a premier who since 2018 has been dismantling and removing the public health in this province, or the public wealth in this province, whether it's, and these are things that the taxpayers have created, whether it's a green belt, it's public education, it's public health. There's a number of other things that they are attacking, and basically they're going after the public wealth the way a bunch of drunken gold miners go after gold. And what I'm wondering is, with what you've been doing over the last year, how much of a role can opposition parties play versus significant activism across the province? Because my feeling is it's the activism across the province that really gets the attention of those who are currently in power. And you can't really count on certainly can't count on the Liberals, and we'll have to see what the NDP can do.
That's a great question. The Green Belt fight is likely over. However, you know, the fight for Ontario isn't, right? So I think what happened, and I think Fort Fest, the counter protest, is a good example of that. We had teachers, we had healthcare workers, and we had environmentalists working together. And we need to build on that momentum. And we couldn't have done it without each other. The Ontario Federation of Labor and the teachers brought us into that fold. We helped them. I'll give you a backstory. So with Ford Fest, it took place at Binghamton's. And it's, if you can believe this, the Binghamton has three entrances, and it's 1.2 kilometers in length along the frontage there. So it's a huge space. The oil organizers were a little bit nervous because the rally was starting at 5, and at quarter after 4, there was only a couple dozen people there. We started putting out lawn signs along that stretch of the road. And at about 4:45, I said to the organizer, I said to Jeff, "Hey, Jeff, where's the sound system?" It's like, "Well, you know, there's so many cops here and we're on private property. I don't feel comfortable pulling out the sound system. It might just get taken away." I said, "Well, we can't really run a rally with, you know, by this point, there's a few hundred people there. Can't really run a rally with a megaphone." So we, luckily I had, we live on a farm, I had the truck there. And I said, "Jeff, you know what, we'll just put the sound system on the truck and we'll use the truck as the, as a stage for the politicians." And so I just pulled up the truck onto the corner of the property, on private property. And I said, "Jeff, if there's a problem, we'll just drive away." You know, it was a learning experience for ourselves, for the OFL, for the educators there, as well as the healthcare workers. But it cemented a relationship. And Jeff and company have asked me to speak at in London in early November at the Ontario Secondary Teachers Federation meeting there. So that momentum is building, right, of different groups that traditionally haven't worked together, at least not since the Mike Harris era. And so we're gelling again, and we need to build that gel that so much is at stake for Ontario. The other thing that I want to emphasize here is Ford has lost moral authority to govern at this point, right? the Greenbelt stench will stick with him for the next 2.5 years. But we need to remind him of that, and we need to remind Ontarians of that. We need to remind ourselves that this is not the way to govern.
First of all, I'd love to thank Mike for coming in. It was been a great presentation. I'd like to expand on picking up on what's been said just previously and start to talk about the anti-democratic process that Ford has engaged with the strong mayor's legislation, the extension of that, with what he's done in terms of the Greenbelt and the way he's approached it, behavior that does border on criminal behavior as well. And seeing what's happening, you know, with the Republicans in the states right now, there is an anti-democratic movement going on. And I think that there's a point where we have to say that has to stop.
I want to bring it back to not so much to the Greenbelt, but to locally, so the strong mayor's powers. We're also seeing the municipalities being strong-armed by the province around housing targets. And, you know, the travesty is, you know, we're almost a year since the Greenbelt carvers were first announced. We've lost a year in terms of actually building housing for Ontarians. It's a travesty, right? And we need to remind this government that they're failing us around housing. Where, you know, why aren't the feds, the province, the municipalities working together hand in hand for true affordable housing, right? You know, what happens at Queen's Park transpires locally. So we need to push back on the strong mayor's powers when our mayor is flaunting those powers or threatening to use them. We need to push back on these false housing targets that are, you know, are just private sector driven. The municipality has very little, you know, a stake or a hand in terms of pushing developers to address the housing crisis. If we're not addressing the true nature of the crisis, which is high interest rates, which is wages are too low, which is, you know, so many other issues that are contributing to the housing crisis. We need to remind this government that its own housing task force had some great recommendations that have not been implemented. The last time I checked, I think 20 of the 73 recommendations have been implemented from the housing task force. And that task force released this report 2 years ago. Again, lost time, right? So, you know, when those issues come to council around housing targets, around strong mayor's powers, around Bill 23, we have a role to play in that and to remind our local politicians that are they going to mimic what's happening at Queen's Park or are they going to champion what's important to Guelphites?
Those are two great last questions. Mike, I really want to thank you for attending here and giving us this update. I think it's extremely important, and I think it's important for us to appreciate how significant the Greenbelt activism was in terms of many other things. I wholeheartedly agree that strong mayor powers are something that need to be resisted, and dare I say, for most people, they don't understand it. Consequently, we needed the Greenbelt activism to do that. I'm also reminded what my late friend Carol Milligan was told by Ralph Nader once when Ralph phoned Oprah when I answered the phone. Once you're an activist, you'll never be lonely again. So if you're ever bored, come on out to a rally. And if you ever find yourself with a couple of extra dollars in your wallet, remember the Greenbelt and Water Watchers and every activist organization that can use a buck. Because unlike federal, provincial, and municipal politics, they're not funded by developers. Thanks, Mike.
Hi, everyone. There's lots to have your say about. First off is the Emma to Earl Street Bridge, the Downtown Infrastructural Renewal Project. And there will be a survey soon about the Downtown Heritage Conservation District study. And please vote by October 9th about two playground updates. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we're going to find out what's going on at 10C. They've taken over the farmers market. They've got shared workspaces. a community kitchen, and much more. And coming up on Breezy Breakfast, we'll be interviewing our MP, Lloyd Longfield, and we'll be having some spooky stories told by Bonnie Dirtnell, Susan Ratcliffe, and the Jay Walker. Thank you all for being here, and I believe that's a wrap. Peace out.
That's all for today. Thank you for listening. Music is provided by Jules Germ. Post-production by Scotty Hertz. Breezy Breakfast, where the coffee is strong enough to get you going to a protest. See you next time.